This is the ESPNU College Football Podcast. Your host today, Ivan Maisel.
Hello and welcome to the ESPNU College Football Podcast. It's Tuesday, April 20th. This is Ivan Maisel, senior writer at ESPN.com, live in Bristol, Connecticut. And I am joined from Pittsburgh, PA, where he's watching the NBA playoffs with great interest, Beano Cook.
Well, maybe 2 minutes a game, but outside of that, I'm surviving. The big story of in Pittsburgh, of course, is Ben Roethlisberger, who better learn how to be an adult and not get into so much trouble. But outside of that, I'm like you. I'm waiting for the beginning of the 142nd season of college football.
It's really not that far away, is it? We're at the tail end of spring ball, which means that it can't be far away.
Yeah, the Penn State has its game Saturday. Pitt had its game last Saturday. It isn't that far, but we still have to suffer through baseball. Like baseball?
I actually do like baseball, but that's because I grew up in Mobile, you know, where we had, you know, everywhere you turned, you heard about Hank Aaron and Willie McCovey and Billy Williams were the heroes of my youth.
It's amazing how many came from that area.
It really is. And now it's a great football recruiting area, which says more, I think, about Americans and what sports they love than it does about anything about Mobile per se. You know, Nick Saban made it a big point to get into Mobile when he became coach at Alabama, and he has done quite well there. And
we've seen a lot of players. In other words, were players from Mobile not going to Alabama or Auburn, or were they just going to Auburn and not Alabama?
They were going more to Alabama, but they were also going, you know, Jamarcus Russell went to LSU is probably the most famous example. And LSU had a very good cornerback who also from Mobile who also went there and started. And, of course, now I can't remember his name. But anyway.
Got an email on it.
Yeah. I want to say Shavis Jackson, but I can't even remember if that's right. Beano, since it is late April, there's another harbinger of this time of year, and it's the BCS meetings, which have begun in Scottsdale. They always meet at the site of where the next championship game will be. And the meetings got a little more interesting over the weekend when the Chicago Tribune wrote a story saying that the Big Ten presidents – and the Big Ten Conference in general were accelerating the pace of their expansion plans, and that it was quite possible that Jim Delaney, the commissioner, will lay out some of those plans at the BCS meetings to the other commissioners this week. And we don't, unfortunately, by the time everybody hears this, it may have happened, and you and I at this point don't know what will happen. But the whole idea of expediting the expansion really makes everybody a little nervous. We could see a lot of change coming up in a very short period of time.
Yeah, you keep hearing it's definitely going to be three teams. We all thought it would be one. I did. It looks like it as if it definitely would be three, and some think they might go to 16 teams. I think they're making a big mistake. I think they're overestimating the income they're going to get, and also, as we mentioned in the last show, the money they get will be spent. It's going to be spent. I mean,
well, of course.
You live up to your means, and you will never have enough. You can never be too rich or too thin, as somebody once said. I guess I don't know why they would go to 16 teams. Just arrogance.
Well, I think it's also got something to do with the business that our beloved employer is in, and that I think they need inventory for the Big Ten Network. I think that's got something to do with it.
Well, maybe. I think if they went to 14, okay, going to 16, that would be something. It might happen. Now, let me ask you, do you think Notre Dame will stay independent or join the Big Ten? And I think Notre Dame's in the mix because the Notre Dame people tell me times change. As I said in the last show, in 1954, if you told the graduates of Notre Dame the school would sometime be co-ed within the next 20 years, they would have laughed at you. And COVID.
Yeah.
So
that's a good point.
What do you think? I still think they will stay independent. It's yes or no. You can't be hesitant. You have to say, yes, you think they join the Big Ten. No, they won't.
Well, I think they're going to join the Big Ten, and this is why I think it. First of all, the Big Ten and Notre Dame are like, they're like a couple in a sitcom. You know, when one's interested, the other one's not. And it's been that way for decades. But the problem is, if the Big Ten expands, Beano, and say, you know, if they were to go east, for instance, and if they take a couple of teams from the Big East, then all of a sudden the Big East is really scrambling. And, you know, Notre Dame could get into a situation where the Big East says to them, listen, you know, we've given you a home for all your other sports.
Especially basketball, yeah.
Especially basketball. You know, if you don't bail us out on football, then, you know, hit the bricks. And then all of a sudden, Notre Dame's in a situation where they don't have a home for all their other sports.
That is exactly what people close to Notre Dame is saying, just what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that's a scenario that Notre Dame may look and say, for the good of the entire program, you know, we've got to go to the Big Ten. And I don't know. I mean, that's certainly not a step down. I mean, I know they love being independent, but I think if they were in the Big Ten, it would just be a boon for the league. And I think it would, the university would do quite well. You know, now, is that going to happen? I don't know, but I think, you know, the way that everything has set up, I'm not sure that they may, you know, at some point they may not have a choice. They may have to commit to one league or the other.
Well, that's definitely the way it would happen, but I still think they will be independent. So we have a small wager on that. I don't know what it is. We never see each other, but, well, you say they will join, I say they won't.
Okay. Is there a time limit on that, or just
open? Well, on this expansion. I mean,
okay.
Expansion. I think
okay.
I give you the 2014. Yeah, I give you 4 years.
Okay. All right, good. The BCS, there's not a whole lot of other business at the BCS meetings of any great consequence, Beano. They are not at the point, since we're just now beginning a new four-year cycle, they're not at the point where they're going to begin to look at it with any great seriousness at a plus one. I mean, it's...
No, I agree. That's how they're going to get more money.
Yes.
Do you think we will, starting with the 2014 season, do you think we will have plus one?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that solves a lot of problems.
Well,
it solves the problem for schools like Boise State and Utah and BYU. If those schools go undefeated, if they're 12-0, they will be one of the four teams.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, whoever the fifth team is going to get mad, but, you know, that's a problem. I think if the basketball expands to 96, as it appears it will, then the 97th team is going to be mad.
Nobody's ever happy.
No, except for me and you. The NCAA Football Rules Committee, Beano, has, and this is a problem that all of America was on the edge of its seat to see how they would handle, has decided you can no longer write a message on your eye black.
Yeah, that's the Tebow rule. That's where that came from,
yeah,
obviously.
You know, it first became popularized with Reggie Bush a few years ago.
Area code?
He would do his area code, and then Tebow began to write biblical...
That changes everything.
Notations or, you know...
Separation of church and state, separation of church and college football.
Yes, I had never looked at it that way, and I'll have to reread the Constitution closely, but I think that you're onto something there. It made people just uncomfortable enough that they just decided to do away with it. So we have, we'll now have clean eye black, and, the NCAA is going to, ratchet up the pressure on the players to, behave on the field taunting will now be considered a live penalty. So it means it will affect that play rather than a penalty being assessed after the play. And the difference in the example that everybody is giving is that if a player is high steps into the end zone or vamps as he goes into the end zone, then rather than have that penalty assessed after the touchdown on the kickoff, it will be assessed on that play, and there will no longer be a touchdown, in which case I'm guessing there will no longer be a player because his coach would do away with him.
Well, the way I feel about that, I think that's going a little too far.
I think the penalty is going too far.
If you, especially in interconference games, you have, Michigan playing UCLA during the regular season, and the official is from one conference and it's called against a player for another conference. I mean, again, you're making a judgment call, and, well, that's a tough call. That's a tough call.
Yes.
I don't think it should be that way. I think what it should be, if you want to make it tough, I mean, you got to find another way. Especially, in other words, you don't have neutral officials in the interconference games. I don't know why. I've been complaining about that ever since they stopped it. I think it's stupid not to. Then you have that problem again. I think I'm against all that taunting. And it's nice to see the Army-Navy game. You never see it. But, it's judgment. And that puts pressure on the officials.
Well, you brought up Army. I do want to point out, and this is a sign that Army is alive and well, or at least getting well in college football, that the Bell Helicopter Armed Forces Bowl in Fort Worth has made a deal with Army to play there this year if the Black Knights qualify for a bowl game, which I think
it's six wins, right?
That's six wins, and it's been a while since Army has been in a bowl game. It's been,
they gave Auburn a heck of a game 1 year.
Yeah, they did, and that was, I think, when Bob Sutton was the coach, and I believe it was 1996, and that was in the Sun Bowl, and Army had started the season 10-0, lost at Syracuse at the end of the season, and then played Auburn right to the last whistle. And that is completely from memory, but I did cover that team when they started out the season 10-0, and it should be pointed out that firing Bob Sutton was one of the worst decisions Army has made in many years in football, and it's only now just beginning to show signs of real life under Rich Ellison. Beano, I did want to bring up, I was in Boise the last time we did the show, and you referred to them a minute ago in terms of their position in the BCS, if there ever were a plus one, and I had the chance to have a long interview with Chris Peterson, the coach, and I was asking him about the kind of player that he recruits and how, you know, obviously a blue chip guy is not going to look at Boise first, and this is Chris talking about what they look for in a player.
What we get is we get players that don't necessarily fit the mold that everybody's looking for. But they're still good players, and then our coaches do a very good job of developing them. You know, I know when we kind of first came here, you know, in some ways it was, there'd be a kid out there, like, I know some of the other schools, you know, some of the other places out there, like, man, I'd like to take that kid, but just couldn't because maybe he just didn't look the part or whatever. Well, that doesn't bother us.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might be a few inches short or, you know, something, but he's a good player. The main thing is, and, you know, we tell the high school coaches, it's, you know, certainly in Idaho, it's like, hey, we still want the same guys. Now, if they're a little bit taller, a little bit faster, you know, that's great. We'll take that too. But we need that same blue-collar, tough kid that loves football and is a good player. And it starts with that.
And what's fascinating about that is just his notion that they want a kid who loves football, and that's what they look for. A tough blue-collar kid, is how he put it. And that they find that that works for them more effectively than chasing after the guy that fits the physical mold.
Yeah, they're not going to, in most cases, they're not going to get that kid. It's remarkable what Boise State has done, in my opinion. Just remarkable. I mean, nobody lives in Idaho, do they?
Well, they told me that there are 500,000 or 600,000 people in the Treasure Valley where Boise is, and it's the state capital. And
do they have good high school football? Do they get? I should know this. Do they get a lot of players from Idaho itself?
Yeah, they do, but they get probably just as many from Southern California. Well, actually, all over California.
Different in Oregon, then.
Not so much in Oregon. You know, there's not a lot of players. Oregon doesn't get a whole lot of players from Oregon. I think Chip Kelly only signed two or three players.
No, Oregon goes to California.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
They all do.
Yeah, they all do, and just as everybody goes to Texas. Chris Peterson, 49-4 in four seasons there, and the other thing he said that I found really interesting, I wanted to let everyone hear it now, is I just asked him about the notion that people are going to come after him for his success and the lure of a bigger school.
I watch other coaches go different places, and it's just so easy to see that the grass is not always greener. I mean, yeah. And I'm not even talking if they go somewhere else and struggle. I'm just talking they might go somewhere else and do well, but I see and I know some of these guys, and I see the headaches that come with it, and it's like, you just trade one set of problems for another.
Yeah.
And I've just kind of always asked myself when something's come up, I said, if I take this next, if I make this move, does my life get better?
Yeah.
And, at this point, I haven't been able to answer that, yes.
and that's a guy that's got his priorities right, just the fact that he understands that the grass may not be greener at a bigger place just because there's more attention and his salary is bigger. I mean, that's a pretty shrewd guy.
Yeah, I think it, I'm not saying he would not leave someday, but he's smart enough to realize maybe there are only certain jobs he would leave for. Al Golden, I got a nice note from him, from Temple, because we'd be mentioning him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, nice note. And I wrote, and I said, I know you hesitate as a Penn State grad to take any advice from a Pitt grad. Just don't take a job to get a job. In other words, make sure wherever you go, it's someplace that it's just not to go somewhere else. I thought he would get the Virginia job, and I think if offered, he would have taken it. But he's like, he's smart. Look for something that Tennessee would have been perfect for him. This guy, in my opinion, is good. He's very good. When you can win 9 straight at Temple, and I don't care who the opponents are, we know what Temple's done in recent years. He won at Navy this year.
Yes.
And so.
And really pushed UCLA to the limit in the Eagle Bank Bowl game.
They had a lead on UCLA.
In the fourth quarter, sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yes.
So, the right job, leave. If you think it's the right job, just don't take a job to move up into a higher league. Patino left Kentucky to take the Celtic job, and to this day, I bet he regrets it.
Well, and what we all forget with these guys, with the type of person that becomes a head coach, is that they are intensely competitive people. So the ability to recognize that where you are is just as good or better than what you think is the next rung up the ladder is really hard for these guys to grasp. And they all, they've all fallen victim to it. Patino did. Nick Saban, goes to the NFL, comes back. Pete Carroll comes back from the NFL and now has gone back to the NFL. I think part of it is that whatever makes them tick, that competitive fire.
Well, Pete Carroll he did not win in the NFL, and it's
exactly
probably bugs him. But speaking of Pete Carroll, what's going on at USC in the investigation? Have you heard anything?
We expect to hear soon, and I say that because it has been exactly 2 months since the NCAA had its hearing in Tempe, Arizona, at which they asked USC to make its defense and explain what happened. And generally, in the past, the NCAA has announced its findings 6 to 8 weeks after a hearing. This hearing was a day longer than usual, which indicates...
And USC's in real trouble.
It indicates there's a lot of stuff to go through, and it's certainly not a good sign for USC, but we should hear soon, and I would not be surprised if we'll be talking about it on our next show. Bino, you mentioned Tennessee and Al Golden. Of course, Derek Dooley is the head coach there. We've got a story posting on ESPN.com about what has about the Vols and what has been a rocky couple of months as Dooley has come in asked two or three players to leave the program, or if not, they've left of their own accord, by all accounts, it's going to be a long road back, and that may have something to do. It's possible that Lane Kiffin saw how much of a struggle it was going to be, and I think it's more the case that Lane Kiffin had his dream job at USC and just left, but it could be a long road back for Tennessee, and it's been a long time since Tennessee has not been a contender in the SEC East.
Yeah, he has to play Georgia and Alabama and Florida every year. That's awful rough. That's awful rough. And that's why the road is a long way back. If you look before the Southeast Conference went to 12 teams, Tennessee and Florida didn't play that many times against each other.
No.
I mean, I understand. It's like Alabama and Georgia. They both ducked each other for years. It's not easy to win that league. It's not easy. Now, they got Vanderbilt and Kentucky. They should usually beat them. But those other three teams, I mean, that's brutal.
Oh, yeah. It is, and it never stops, as you point out. And Tennessee and Alabama are, the way the SEC schedule works, you have one permanent opponent in the opposite division.
And that's Alabama.
And that's due to the great history of that rivalry. And it's a lot of work that Tennessee has every fall. And it's usually their toughest games are over by the end of October. Phil Fulmer always had a great record in November because that's when he got Kentucky and Vanderbilt. And at any rate, a couple of things about Derek Dooley that came up in our last podcast. Somebody wrote in and was talking about father and son coaches, and we didn't at the time have anything in front of us. Well, obviously, our listeners come to the rescue. Bradley Kelly wrote in and pointed out that Jim Tressel's dad, Lee, was a very good coach at Baldwin Wallace near Cleveland. And then Tex Noel from the Intercollegiate College Researchers Association. I think it's Intercollegiate College Researchers Association or something to that. I'm sorry if I butchered that, but Tex wrote in and sent a whole spreadsheet of father and son coaches.
Well, we were kind of looking for famous, but we appreciate the interest. I mean,
oh, yeah. Well, he pointed out the Harbaughs, Jim Harbaugh at Stanford and his dad, Jack.
Yeah, Trussell, I don't think we, one was at Baldwin Wallace and the other at Ohio State. What we were looking for were the ones who were, won national titles or came close. But, I mean, we appreciate the fact that he sent all those in. Harbaugh, I completely forgot about that.
Well, sure. And obviously, Lane Kiffin, Monty coached at North Carolina State.
We knew those kind of coaches. Yeah, we knew that.
Yeah. Dave and Steve Cragthorpe. Steve, late of Tulsa and Louisville. His father, Dave, was at Oregon State. A few gosh, I think in the 80s. And then Jim Dickey at Kansas State. His son Darryl was at North Texas. So anyway, Tex, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And also, we had another question about lawyers who had become head coaches, of which Derek Dooley is one. And we had some other readers write to us and point out that Mike Leach, of course, the former Texas Tech coach, has his law degree, and Rick Neuheisel at UCLA. Of course, the story about that is that Rick Neuheisel went to law school at USC. He's got degrees from his alma mater and his employer and from his employer's arch rival, which reminded me that Bo Schembechler used to always say he, of course, was a graduate of Ohio State because he got a graduate degree there when he was on Woody Hayes' staff in Columbus in the 60s.
The great line is when John Kennedy spoke at Yale and got an honorary degree, he said, "Now I got the best of both worlds, a Harvard education and a Yale degree." Great lines. I don't know. When you brought that up about those guys going to different places, that made me think of that. And we have a lot of young listeners, so I know that they might not have heard of that quote, but that was a great line. He spoke at commencement at Yale and gave that quote. That's one of my favorites.
That's very good, and Kennedy might have been he might have had the quickest wit of any president in my lifetime.
Oh yeah, very well. He's Irish. I'm only 50% Irish, but when you're 100% Irish, you have a lot of wit.
Yeah,
that God gave the Irish great smiles and wit. And he gave that to them.
So, if you're half Irish, are you only funny from like noon to midnight, or
been like that?
Yeah, okay.
Been like that. we appreciate getting information like that we don't know, or we are neglected remembering. And I didn't know about Dickey. I didn't know about some of them, and on Neuheisel, I didn't know what he had a law degree.
I think he played in the USFL.
Yeah, did you know that he had a law degree?
Yes,
I didn't know that.
I had just.
Did you know it was USC?
Well, I remembered once we got the email, I said, "Oh yeah," because
he wanted to be near the Golden Girls.
Well, that might have been it, and then he.
What do they call them?
The Sweater Girls or the Song Girls?
The Song Girls, yes. The Golden Girls. I'm thinking of the TV show.
Yeah, I don't think Bea Arthur was one of the Song Girls.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
The song.
If I'm wrong about that, somebody will write in.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. They give us the entire cast. We know the entire cast.
Yeah. Neuheisel got his law degree, then decided to coach instead, and he was a GA under Terry Donahue at UCLA and helped Troy Aikman when Troy transferred from Nebraska to UCLA.
What do you hear about UCLA and their team this year? Have you heard anything?
Well, they are one of the more fascinating stories of the spring. I'm glad you brought that up because Norm Chow, who has produced one All-American quarterback after another in his illustrious career as an offensive coordinator at BYU. He was at for Lavelle Edwards' entire tenure, I believe, or close to it, and then went to North Carolina State and helped Phillip Rivers, and then went to USC with Carson Palmer and Matt Leinart. Norm Chow's always been a pro-set guy, and this spring, they have adapted the offense that Nevada has used so well that's called the pistol. It's not quite a shotgun. It's sort of a hybrid. UCLA is looking very hard at trying to figure out how to run the ball better and yet be able to throw the way that UCLA has thrown it. And Norm Chow's offenses have always thrown it. And Nevada led the nation in rushing last year, I believe. And so that's an experiment that everybody will be watching very closely. And UCLA has, as usual, a tough September. I believe they go to Texas or in September. They play Houston out in at the Rose Bowl in September, and we're going to find out very quickly you know, how well Kevin Prince, the quarterback who is the heir apparent, or not the heir apparent, he played most of last year when he was healthy, adapts to this this new offense.
UCLA and USC, boy, give them credit. They go out and play tough non-conference games.
Well, they have to.
Yeah, they, a lot of Big Ten schools should learn from that, but they won't.
Well, you know, they have to because they're in a big city, and and the people there are not going to buy tickets to see him play Western Carolina.
They're not. That's true.
Yeah, you know, speaking of which, one more little item about Boise State. Gene Blamire, the athletic director there, told me while I was out there he plans to introduce legislation in the NCAA that would ban, essentially ban guarantee games. It would say very simply that if you schedule a game, it has there has to be a home and home. And yeah, it good luck is right. It's I'm not sure that he'd ever get a majority for that. But the way he sold it, Bino, it was a wonderful display of logic. He said, "Listen," he said, basically, he said, "If college football's method of scheduling was adapted by the pro sports," he said, "the Yankees would never leave the Bronx, and nobody would ever go to Green Bay."
But that's true.
Yeah, and
that you know that isn't the way it is. I mean,
yes,
he has as much chance of getting that it's a good idea, and maybe it should be, but the rule, but it's he has no shot.
Well, and what I like about it is that it is wonderfully logical, and by turning it down, it's a little embarrassing to the schools in power to look at that and say, well, we're not going to do that because we don't have to. And I'm sure that they will get over their embarrassment very, very quickly. You want to do some mailbag? Because we got several letters this week. This was one of my favorites from Andy Hess in Cincinnati. He loves the podcast, he said, and he said, "I'd love to hear Bino's historical perspective on a topic of personal interest to me. My grandfather played in the Notre Dame marching band during the last 2 years of Newt Rockne's coaching tenure. My grandfather was with the band in November 1929 when Notre Dame beat Army 7-0 at the Polo Grounds in New York, a game which capped off an undefeated national championship season for the Irish. In their celebration after the game, the Notre Dame band tore down one of the goalposts, which at the time were made of wood, and on the train ride back to South Bend, the band members cut the post into small sections and divided it up among themselves. My grandfather passed away almost a decade ago, but that small section of goalpost is still my most prized piece of family history." Andy himself, a Notre Dame grad, class of 03. He said, "I really enjoy hearing Bino's perspective on that game in 1929 or his general thoughts on how common of a practice it was for bands in that era to knock down goalposts. And also, since Notre Dame will play Army this fall at the new Yankee Stadium, if Bino has any stories about the Polo Grounds and its historical significance in college football and sports in general."
So. Well, no, Notre Dame, it's going to be a night game. Dick Ebersol from NBC wants that to be a night game. So the Army and Notre Dame game is going to be at night. And I have a friend, Terry Shields, class of 71, was going to go to that game until he found out it was going to be at night. Tickets for where he wanted, I don't know if it's every seat in the stadium, but they're $125. And they would get it. As for that game, I think Army was also undefeated. I'm not sure, but I think the 7-0, I think a player by the name of Elder returned an intercepted pass for 90 yards. I could be wrong. I think that was in that game. And goalposts used to come down more than they used to, and they do now. For instance, in 1935, Notre Dame won that Ohio State game, and the goalposts did not come down again after any game until 1952.
Wow.
And so I don't know what the band did it, but that's an interesting story.
That's a great story. And
oh, it's a type of story that should be done in game day. I mean, if he still has the goal piece of the goalpost, it's an interesting story for game day. But as I kid my friends in game day, it happened before 1979, so they won't be interested. I'm sticking the needle in. Don't get mad at me. But that's great stuff. I'm bands. You know, my only complaint about bands today is they don't want to play show music. They want, you know, they don't play football music. When was the last time you went to a football game and a band played? Remember the song Mr. Touchdown USA?
Oh, yeah. Well,
I've
heard
that
it.
That anymore. All these band directors, there used to be a guy in Alabama. And when the game was on TV, he had one band member hold a TV set so he could see whether the band was on ABC or not.
Oh, that's great.
And then Bud Wilkinson told me about a band director at Oklahoma who wanted to, before the Texas game, wanted to scout the Texas band. And that's, I mean, they're great people. Look, people in the band, I mean, that's a lot of work.
Yes.
I remember a great story of Father Hesburgh in his book, God, you know, God, Country, Notre Dame, where when it was getting close to the fall, he would hear the band practicing, and he would turn to somebody and say, "We're back in business."
It's beautiful.
I love that. I love that. So I love Father Hesburgh. I don't like Notre Dame, but I love Father Hesburgh. I think he's probably the greatest college president of the 20th century. But again, that's a great story, Andy. And both Ivan and I thank you for sending it in. And good luck with the Cincinnati Reds finishing fifth or last.
What I remember about the band's last season is that after the death of Michael Jackson, I think I heard Thriller on every campus every Saturday for the entire fall, which as much as I love Thriller, that was a little much.
Yeah. They all want to be Bernstein.
Yes.
Yeah, like all the band directors. But thank God for the band directors. College, the one thing that I always liked about going to a Redskin game in RFK, it was like a college game with that band. And that's the only place I've ever been which had a college atmosphere on Sunday was Washington. Now, I hear FedEx is terrible. I hear it's a terrible place for the fans.
It's tough to get to. That's true.
But I don't know. I've never been there. But RFK with the band, the bands are great. When they play, they play the victory march at Notre Dame. It's great. Or the victors, or whatever your school is.
Yes.
And they play Hail to Pitt at Pitt, or they play Hail to the Line at Penn State. I get a shiver. I'm getting old. I am old. But it's something about the bands. And that's what makes college football. The bands help. But these bands, remember this. If there was no football game, no, as great as you are, nobody would show up on Saturday.
Well, that's true.
What's your favorite band? I mean, Alabama got the $1 million tag. The $1 million band when they went to the Rose Bowl, right?
I don't know. I just know that they sounded like they sounded like $1 million was what I was always.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the terrorist bands like Rice and Stanford and the ones that are just goofy. I just think that's they make me laugh and they still make me laugh.
The Ivy League, during the Vietnam War, when the Columbia band said, "We dedicate this song to President Johnson, good law, goodbye." It's, what's that song? Goodbye, it's been nice to know you. And then
exactly.
The Yale band, Yale was going to merge with Vassar.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you, they split the band in half and made it a V and a Y. Now you figure it out. With the alumni, I might add.
Yeah, probably did not go well. I don't think that stood for victory either.
Yeah.
One other letter I want to get to very quickly, Cal Sherrill in Austin, Texas, just for his opening line. He said, the off-season podcast is like a Berlin airlift for college football fans. Thank you.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. He wanted to ask you, Beano, what is the most ethically questionable action a sports information director could get away with in your day? And what is the most ethically questionable action an SID could get away with today?
You can't get away with anything today.
Yeah.
The big problem today is you don't work for the university. You work for the football coach. It used to be the AD would hire, the AD would fire. The football coach, if he's big enough, he can fire the SID.
Yes.
Now, when I'm trying to think crazy things that when I was an SID, it went on. Things that weren't ethical. I really can't think anything top of my head.
Probably had to do with when y'all would have those meetings in Chicago at the College All-Star Game and you would hit Rush Street, that would be my guess.
That's right. And if it in, yeah, that's right. And if you did not, you still had an expense account. You turned it in. I think the most unethical thing that the SIDs did was when they went on the road and if they had a date or they would see him, their wife, and took somebody to dinner, they would put a sports writer's name on the expense account.
That's what makes America great.
Yeah. That's the most unethical thing I ever did. Really. You know, I remember when I went to ABC and Rune Arledge, the president of ABC Sports, hired me, and he said, when you're on the road for 3 or 4 days, I don't expect you to sit around in the hotel room and do nothing. And what he was saying is, if I went out and had a date or something like that, I could put on the expense account. That's what he was saying. They never said that when I worked at Pitt.
I'm still waiting to get that message here as well, although I probably...
Oh, times have changed.
Hall of Fame birthdays, Beano. Yesterday, the 19th, Jack Pardee, the great Texas A&M player under Bear Bryant, who went on to become a successful head coach both at the University of Houston and in the NFL. And then today, the old ball coach himself, the 1966 Heisman Trophy winner and the coach who won the 1996 national championship, Steve Spurrier, now at South Carolina.
Yeah, one of the great. He's one of my favorites.
Yes.
One of my favorites. You know, when he did he spoke before a group of 300 or 400. What they do in Florida, the head football coach goes around the state. I don't know if it's in May. I guess it's after spring practice. Pensacola, they have alumni everywhere in that state. And before 300 alumni somewhere, he said the Free Shoes University crack about Florida State.
Right.
And he said, I was speaking to a private group. I'm surprised it made the newspaper. So, you know, Franklin said 3 people can keep a secret, but if only 2 are dead. I mean, he knew it would be in the paper. You know, what I like about Spurrier is that he would say what he thinks.
Exactly.
And the writers would take him apart, and then they would take apart the right coaches who say nothing.
Yeah.
They give you the old cliches, they have the advantage, they're playing at home, they write it down, and they write it's the same old stuff. Spurrier would give you something different.
He gives you a straight answer. You ask him a question, he answers it.
Sure. Spurrier's one of my favorite people of all time, and I don't know, I haven't spent much time with him. I did interview him for the Heisman Trophy series back in 95. I did it in 95. One of my disappointments is they discontinued him, and it's the only, I've been fired from the scoreboard show and all that. The only thing that really disappoints me is that we didn't continue that series, but Spurrier is one of my favorite players. And also, as you said, number 11 is no longer retired.
That's right. We talked about that on the last show, or a couple of shows ago. April 23rd, Bud Wilkinson, the Hall of Fame coach at Oklahoma, you mentioned a few minutes ago. And April 26th, John Ralston, who was the coach at Stanford, took the then Indians to consecutive Rose Bowls, 1969 and 70, I believe, or 70 and 71.
They all got 69 and 70 seasons.
Right. Yes, which consecutive.
And 71 seasons. That's right, 70 and 71.
Yeah, 70 and 71. Plunkett and Bunce were the quarterbacks, and Stanford
winning. You had a good line yesterday. Won both games.
That's right. It's
what it was like.
Pretty much like splitting the atom for Stanford to win consecutive Rose Bowls.
Yeah, but tougher.
Yes, but tougher.
I want to get back to walking. Some people ask me how college football has changed. Jim Tatum left Oklahoma after the 46 season to take the Maryland job.
That would pretty much explain
it. And the other one we talk about, Wallace Wade left an undefeated, untied Alabama team, won the Rose Bowl to take the job at Duke.
And actually had taken the job the summer before the season.
But like the coaches today,
an
assistant coach up to take over for a year. And that's what Pop Warner did when he left Pitt. He sent out an assistant coach to coach Stanford for a year before his contract was up at Pitt. You won't see that today.
No. Lord, no. Well, Beano?
We fooled him again.
We did. We did. We fooled him again, even though it's late spring. And next time, May 4th, we'll be here. We can discuss the end of spring ball, the end of the Kentucky Derby, and other such fun events. But in the meantime, I enjoyed it. And for everyone here, we want to say thank you for downloading us. This has been the ESPNU College Football Podcast.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNRadio.com.